Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, IBM's Watson gained fame as the first computer to become a Jeopardy champ. Now he's got a new career in customer service. We're going to hear from a head of IBM's Watson unit on what makes this supercomputer tick when solving human problems. But first, 60 years ago last week, Sir Edmund Hillary and Nepalese mountaineer Tenzing Norgay became the first confirmed climbers to summit Mount Everest. More than 3,000 people have since repeated the feat, and the numbers grow along with advances in mountaineering gear and forecasting technology, which make it easier than ever to reach the peak. Along with the unprecedented number of climbers comes the mounting problem of high-altitude traffic jams. John Kelly wrote about Everest climber congestion for BBC News Magazine and joins us with more. John, thanks for joining us.
Not at all.
So give us a sense of the numbers. How many climbers are now attempting to climb Everest?
Well, I mean, to put it in context, in 2012, which is the most recent year for which we've got figures, the most we had climbing in a single day, that's in a 24-hour period, was 234. I mean, if you look at that as recently as 1983, you never had more than 40 people on that summit at any one time. Basically, it's now much easier to get to the top if you're determined enough. In 1990, 18% of all summit attempts were successful, and last year that figure stood at 56%.
Wow, but what are some of the dangers of having so many people on the mountain at the same time?
Well, effectively, it's like a traffic jam. It's like a freeway up there, and it becomes very, very crowded. You have people who are paying up to $100,000 to get to the top, and if they feel that there are people impeding them, then they get very frustrated about it. There's been reports of fights on the way up the mountain and mountain rage, as though you were stuck in traffic.
What are some of the kinds of technological advances that have made it easier for climbers to reach Everest summit?
Well, the most obvious one is oxygen. You've also got clothing is also much more advanced than it used to be. Probably most significant is fixed line ropes, which basically they drill some markers into the ground and it becomes very easy to haul yourself up. Now, you know, nobody's saying that you can get all the way up if you haven't done any training. But in 2010, the youngest person to climb Everest was a Californian called Jordan Romero, who was 13 years old. This year, we had an 80-year-old Japanese man who set the most recent record for the oldest summiteer. You had an 81-year-old attempting it. Everest was once considered impassable. It was once considered unclimbable. You know, the fact that we're seeing people at these extremes of ages would tend to suggest that it's become easier to do because of these technological advances.
It was also at one time considered pristine. Now I've heard reports and read reports of base camp being absolutely littered. It's almost like a border crossing where people leave their, you know, discarded junk behind.
Well, not just base camp on the way up. There are all sorts of reports you hear. I've never been up myself, I should add, of canisters of littering the way. And now they have, and people I've spoken to who've been up there recently say it has been better than it has been in recent years in terms of litter. The authorities seem to have taken some efforts to clean it up. What is becoming more acute is the crowds at the bottom. If you go to base camp, it's like a thriving town. You have restaurants and cafes that are devoted to Westerners. You don't have the sense that it's this pristine, pure, clear, unspoilt natural wilderness.
Well, obviously, somebody's making a lot of money off of those pileups, and I'm wondering about the role of the Nepalese government. You mentioned the authorities here. That would be the Nepalese government. What part does the government play in Everest's traffic problem?
Well, I mean, the Nepalese government does indeed issue the permits, and there's no doubt that they've been issuing more of them. This is a big money spinner. Also, the authorities, I mean, as you may know, the political situation in Nepal is that they had a long-standing civil war, and now there's, I suppose, a kind of political stalemate between the different factions. There's effectively no settled government, so it's very hard to get anything done. Now, the flip side to this is that you have these communities, you know, of Sherpas living on the mountains who effectively depend on getting Westerners up there. They'd have nothing without it. It's not an area where you can grow crops. This has brought wealth and a rising living standards to some people who really didn't have a great deal before.
It also does put some pressure on the government. If the experience is not as good, as pristine, as pure, you know, as uncongested as climbers imagined, they may not go for permits. And this often happens in natural environments where, you know, the rest of the world is watching. Do you think that there would be a sort of pressure on the government of Nepal to pull back on some of the permits?
Well, certainly amongst, you know, the most committed climbers, I think a lot of them are now saying, well, you know, I don't really want to do this. I want to climb K2, or I want to tackle another mountain instead, because this isn't what got me into climbing. But here's the other side of it. Whenever someone gets to the top of Mount Everest and they're the first person to do it from this country, or they're the first woman, or the first 13-year-old, then it becomes a statement, and it's often a political thing. You had a brother and a sister from Pakistan climbed, and that was, you know, about to make a point about gender equality. The first Saudi Arabian woman making a point about gender equality as well. And, you know, these people saw this as an astute way to get their message across. And you could quite legitimately make the point of why should you begrudge them that? And, you know, and even many amongst the committed, serious climbers will say, well, however much they don't like this situation, that they're very uncomfortable with the idea of preventing anyone from going up a mountain if they want to. And you've got a lot of mountains in New Hampshire. I'm sure a lot of your listeners feel there's something, you know, very free and very liberating about climbing. And it's one place where, you know, you shouldn't have the government telling you you can't go there.
John Kelly writes for BBC News Magazine. Thank you so much for your time today.
Not at all.
You can find a link to his article on the traffic jam at Mount Everest at wordofmouthradio.org. You've likely heard about the 17-year cicada, last seen when the Macarena was popular. Long before the insects began to poke out of the ground along the East Coast, this species was making headlines for its wacky life cycle. Nature has plenty of examples of biological oddities, and science journalist Brandon Keim compiled a list of nature's strangest life cycles for Wired. Brandon, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Virginia. Glad to be here.
First, remind us about this 17-year cicada, and there's also a 13-year cicada, apparently. Well, why the evolution of this life cycle?
Well, nobody knows exactly for sure, but the idea is that it evolved over time and nowhere else except on the eastern coast of the United States as a predator defense mechanism. If you only come out of the ground every 13 years or every 17 years, like the ones we're about to see, then it's difficult for predators to specialize in eating you. And when you do emerge, it really doesn't matter how many of you get eaten just because there are billions of you. It's really a force of nature to be reckoned with when they come out.
Quite a strategy, if that's what it is. But some of nature's strangest life cycles evolve from parasitic relationships. Why is that? And what are some examples?
You know, actually, my interest in the entire notion of strange life cycles began with parasites, and it began with one that isn't even on the list. It's a yellow grub that lives in fish. And so what had happened is that about 15 or 20 years ago, my buddy and I caught some smallmouth bass down in the stream behind my mother's house. And then I hope nobody from the Maine Department of Fish and Wildlife is listening. We took some of these bass in a bucket and put them in my mom's pond. And then over the years, we would go and catch them. One day we wanted to eat some, and we caught them and took them back up to the house and went to clean them. And they were just filled with these, you know, wriggling little yellow grubs. And so, you know, I went to learn about the yellow grubs since I couldn't eat the fish. And it turned out that what happened is when there's enough of these in a fish, they drift towards its brain and alter its behavior in such a way that it swims closer to the top of the water and is more likely to be eaten by a heron. And then the parasite needs to be inside the heron in order for the next stage of its life cycle to occur. And then they reproduce and lay their eggs, which drop out of the heron and go back into the water and are picked up by a fish. And, you know, it's just such a complicated multi-stage process. And you see that in so many parasites. And, you know, I don't know if anybody is exactly sure how this evolves over time. Clearly it does, but what are the, you know, the individual genetic and environmental steps necessary to make this happen? It's really a beautiful mystery.
There are also some examples you use of mutual dependence. For one, the symbiotic salamander. Tell us a little bit about that creature.
What happens is, so for a long time, you know, biologists would look at the eggs of of the salamander, and they could see the little flecks of green floating around inside, and so they knew algae was there. But then the question is, you know, so is the algae sort of floating around in the eggs, or is it really part of the organism? And what researchers have found out in the last few years is that the algae is inside the salamanders as they begin to develop. And so they're, you know, in this very happy environment for algae. It's warm and nitrogen rich and all this. And then at the same time, they're also processing nutrients that are thought to be important to salamander development. And it may actually be the case that these algae are with a salamander over the course of its life. And if it's a female, she'll pass the algae on to her offspring. You know, I don't think there's another example in the natural kingdom like that, and I'm sure a biologist will call in and correct me any moment now, but where a creature passes on another complex organism, you know, not just the bacteria that you pass on to your offspring, which we all do, but algae, you know? I mean, you can see them with your naked eye. It's extraordinary.
Well, and that's a symbiotic relationship, but conversely, the whiptail lizard. Now, this is a sort of model of independence. How does the reproductive cycle of the whiptail lizard work?
Here's where we get into some really complex genetics. So the whiptail lizards, there's actually a great many species of them that live in the southwest United States, and many of them have only females, and they reproduce by cloning themselves. So there's no sexual reproduction. They just give birth. It's called parthenogenesis. And, you know, it was actually thought for a long time, you know, that this was some sort of evolutionary dead end, you know, like something went wrong. Now they reproduce without sex. And over time, there's not going to be enough genetic diversity in their populations for them to be sustained. But, you know, what we've figured out now, or what we realize now, is there's something like 80 groups of animals that over time have, you know, accumulated the mutations they needed in order to go sex-free. And so this does seem to be a pretty successful way of going about your life. You know, it's also, in addition to species that go without sex, there's also quite a few species that change sex in the course of their lives. One of these, the clownfish, best known from Finding Nemo, they're what are called sequential hermaphrodites.
This is the species that actually changes from male into female, which is unlike most hermaphroditic species.
That's right. There's quite a few species out there where the females turn into males, but with clownfish, it's the opposite. And actually, what may happen when Nemo grows up is that if he lives in a colony where the dominant female dies or is eaten, then the next ranking, the highest ranking male, will become a female and take her place.
We're talking with Brandon Keim about some of nature's more bizarre life cycles and phenomena. He's a science journalist who wrote about the subject for Wired magazine. You write about another species, the migratory eel, that has a bizarre back and forth in order to reproduce. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, right from the beginning, eels really go the other way. Every other migratory fish starts out in freshwater. They reproduce in freshwater and are born there. And then they go out to sea, and that's where they become big. And then they go back to freshwater to spawn. But with the eels, it's the opposite. They actually are born at sea, and they're these tiny little, you know, glass eels is what they're called, you know, a few centimeters long and, you know, transparent to the naked eye. And for a long time, scientists didn't even realize that they were the same species as adult eels. They're just completely different creatures. And so they're out there somewhere in the Sargasso Sea, and the currents take them close to land. And somehow, they just know to swim up rivers. And at this point, they are still genderless. Somewhere along this journey, they change sex. They become male or female, and nobody really knows exactly what that trigger is and what determines it. And then at some point, they go back out. And what's really amazing is that they will swim back to where they were born, you know, as these tiny little fingerlings, thousands of miles out in the sea, you know, with, let's say, a salmon, a creature that is, when it's born in a stream, and, you know, it's still incredible that it's able to find its way back there to spawn as an adult, but it's at least it's a fixed point in space, and you can kind of imagine how it is that maybe it gets imprinted with that location geomagnetically or what have you. But with eels, they're swimming back not to a fixed point in the ocean, but to some sort of particular place where the current does a certain thing, or, you know, some water feature, essentially, which is going to be drifting over time. Somehow they find their way back to that thousands of miles away out in the Sargasso.
So, Brandon, you know, as we, in our own very self-absorbed way, look at how we travel through the world and meet different challenges. I mean, do you look at these creatures with their kind of seemingly bizarre life cycles and persistence and way that they navigate the world and think, okay, they have something to teach me?
Well, for myself, I live a fairly straight and narrow lifestyle. But for people who might live one that is less traditional, I think it's nice to look at the natural world and just see the incredible kaleidoscope of possibilities that exists. But I just love knowing that such richness exists in the world. Life is just astounding in its possibilities, and I just like waking up in the morning knowing that.
Brandon Keim is a freelance science journalist. He put together a list for Wired.com. It's called Cicadas Aren't the Only Crazy Ones, Nature's Most Bizarre Life Cycles. We'll have a link to read that at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, a practical guide to changing careers. We're going to look at reinventing the self when word of mouth continues in just a moment.
Word of mouth.
Hello, is there anybody in there?
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Is there an adult out there who has not, in a moment of fatigue or insomnia or on a particularly hard day at work, looked around and asked themselves, is this it? Is this what I want my life to be? Even people who have plenty of money and status and work in their industry of choice may find themselves fantasizing about a job that engages their spirit. A new book from the School of Life series sets out a practical guide to negotiating the myriad choices and overcoming the fear of change and finding a career that has meaning. Roman Kaczmarek is a founding member of the School of Life, and he advises organizations from Oxfam to the UN on using empathy and conversation to create social change. So you write about a number of people who've decided to change their careers and really change their lives. What are some of the common symptoms or feelings that people talked about being dissatisfied with?
Well, one person I actually interviewed for this book, she was so dissatisfied with her job, she was a lawyer actually, that she ended up putting a search term on the internet saying what to do if you hate your career. But she's the kind of person, like many, who feels this kind of fatigue with their work. You know, people who don't have that energy to get up in the morning and sort of bound into work. But it's not simply that. It's this feeling that you're not really in a state of flow in your job. You're not sort of in the zone. You're not in the present. And when you don't have that, that's when job dissatisfaction kicks in. And it's extraordinary that in the United States, job satisfaction levels are at their lowest in recorded history. Only 45% of people are happy in their jobs. So there's a real epidemic of job dissatisfaction.
People tell you, it doesn't feel like it's the permanent me. I feel like an outsider in my job, a little bit of a fraud. What do you think, Roman, are some of the causes or roots of this discontent now, today, with work?
One of the things that happens is that our self and our work gradually drifts out of alignment over time. We're incredibly bad judges of our future selves. So when you're 18 or 24, you might decide to be a lawyer or a radio producer or an elementary school teacher. But what happens is that who we are changes, our interests, our passions, our talents. We have families. And so by the time you get older, there is that divide between who you are and the career that you have. And something needs to be done to close the gap. But the other thing that's happened, of course, is that since the end of the Second World War, there's been rising expectations across the Western world for, you know, work that is more than just a salary. People have a hunger to trade up from money to meaning because they've had their material lives satisfied in some ways and they're looking for something more.
This is a contemporary affliction, though. Fulfillment, you point out, is not even a word found in the first dictionary published by Samuel Johnson in 1755. So in the intervening years, we have this idea that there is this perfect job that would make us jump out of bed in the morning and feel fulfilled. Is there such a thing? Is there a perfect job?
Well, I am pleased to report that there isn't. That means you don't have to worry about it if you don't feel you've got it. There's this great myth that there is one job sort of floating out there in the ether, you know, an ideal vocation that if only we knew what it was, we could just sort of pluck it out of the air and we would be satisfied for life. But what the modern research on career change shows is that the way to find enjoyable work and fulfilling work isn't by just suddenly coming upon this perfect career. The thing is that we have multiple selves, multiple identities, and we need to experiment to find the right job. Take someone like Vincent van Gogh. You know, he wasn't always a painter. He first was a art dealer, then he was a school teacher, then he tried being a book dealer, then he was an evangelical preacher in the Belgian coal mines. Finally, he stumbled upon painting. It took him quite a lot of experiments to find the right job for him. And I think that's the same for many of us. Instead of finding a vocation, we've really got to grow it over time.
Mm. You call it being a wide achiever rather than a deep achiever. So what do you think gets us there? What most inhibits us from changing our careers?
Even though around half people want to change their jobs, around half of those people are too afraid to do so. And there's lots of standard reasons. People feel that they aren't going to achieve as well in a new job. They're worried financially about whether they can do a job that has meaning but take a salary cut. And what actually happens is that people are prey to something that all human beings suffer from, which is a kind of risk aversion. As a psychologist put it, we hate losing twice as much as we like winning, whether that's at the casino table or in a relationship or when trying to find the right career. We tend to exaggerate everything that could possibly go wrong. And that's one of the reasons why people stay in jobs that they've long grown out of.
Roman Krznarek is with us. He's talking about finding meaningful work. And he's a founding member of the School of Life, which consults and produces seminars. And he's the author of the new book, How to Find Fulfilling Work. Well, what you are asking us to do is sort of change this model that we've used when thinking about changing career, meticulously planning. You know, you have to have something lined up before taking the next action. You're urging us instead to act first and reflect later. So what does that mean? We try on new jobs?
That's exactly right. I mean, when the first vocation bureau opened in Boston in 1908, it started selling us a method of finding the right career, which has been around now for a century, which is the idea of the plan and implement model, where you spend lots of time planning and doing research into new careers. You take some psychometric tests, you make long lists of your strengths and weaknesses, and then you try and match those up to a particular profession or job. Then you start sending out resumes and making applications. Now, that method may well get you a job, but it's unlikely to be a fulfilling one because you haven't tried out jobs in the real world. You haven't done experiential learning. So instead of thinking then acting, we need to flip that on its head and act first and think afterwards. And an extreme way to do that is what I think of as a radical sabbatical. So one woman I interviewed for my book, in her 20s, she had a series of miserable jobs in arts administration, and for her 30th birthday, she decided to give herself an unusual present, which was to spend a whole year trying out 30 different careers. So she held down a part-time job to pay the bills, and the rest of the time she was shadowing, interning, volunteering. She was a manager of a cat hotel. She followed a politician around. She was a bed and breakfast review writer. And what she discovered was that finding the right job is a bit like finding the right lover. So you might have 10 criteria for the perfect lover, and you meet someone who ticks all the boxes, and they do absolutely nothing for you. But then you meet somebody who ticks none of your boxes, and they completely blow you away. Mm. And that happens when you can be experimental. The problem, though, is that not everybody feels that they have the courage to do a radical sabbatical, but there's another way of acting first and thinking afterwards, which is to do what are called branching projects. So you hold on to your existing career, and you don't have to dramatically resign on Monday morning and step into the abyss of the unknown. You can start doing experiments on the side. You're an unhappy investment banker on the weekends. You can do some freelance web design or teach yoga on Thursday nights. You start doing these small experiments, and by taking small steps, you gain the courage to take that big final step to do something new.
Roman, you identify three essential ingredients for a fulfilling job. Meaning, I think we've talked about, but flow is something you mentioned earlier, and freedom. I'd love you to tell us more about this concept of flow. What do you mean by that?
So flow is a concept which was invented by a Hungarian-American psychologist called Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. And the idea of flow is when you're doing activity and you're totally in the zone, the past and future don't matter, you feel totally in the present. You're completely absorbed, whether you're a heart surgeon or you're giving a presentation at the office. And the idea is that to gain fulfillment, you want to maximize being in these flow states. And one of the ways to do it is to set yourself tasks, which are challenging and creative, but not so easy that you get bored doing them, but not so difficult that you're afraid of failing. And Csikszentmihalyi says, well, we can recalibrate our own jobs to give ourselves more of these flow-like tasks. But the thing is, if you're an miserable, unhappy IT manager and you've got a nasty boss, you may not have the space to do that. You might have to look for flow outside your existing career. And when I'm teaching classes at the School of Life in London and in other countries too, I often ask people to think about keeping a flow diary for a month. So at the end of the day, you simply note down when you were in this state of flow and what were you doing. Was it when you were standing up and giving a talk at work, or was it when you were cooking a supper for, you know, 12 relatives on a Sunday lunchtime? And that is going to give you clues about what flow really looks like for you as an individual.
Flow may also not be the option for, let's say, that peasant farmer on the slopes or of the Andes, or even a Greek civil servant with a college degree. They may not have the luxury of finding fulfilling work that flows. It's kind of a first world problem, isn't it?
What's really interesting is if you talk to people from all walks of life and in many countries, whether they're taxi drivers or investment bankers, more and more people actually are searching for meaning. But of course, it doesn't mean that everybody has it within their grasp. Sometimes you may not have the choice to find flow in your job and that kind of flexibility. And one of the things that we can try and do is to try and make our existing jobs more enjoyable. And what the research shows there is that what really matters to people is having autonomy and good relationships and a sense of respect. I mean, I used to be a college professor and I gave it all up to experiment with being a professional gardener. And I was shocked to discover that I was really unhappy as a gardener because I wasn't getting respect from people. People would walk straight past when I was weeding in the rain and not take any notice of me. And I didn't even realize that really mattered to me. So there's things like respect that we can try and find in work, even if we can't necessarily find a job that uses all of our passions and all of our talents.
I'm just wondering about growing a vocation. I mean, people inventing their own jobs. Are we going to be living in a world of, you know, yoga teachers and beekeepers and ethical pig farmers with nobody working in the factories?
Well, it's really interesting that this has been the great revolution of our time, the rise of flexible working, the rise of working from home. A lot of big companies are trying to rein in their workers and take away that flexibility, including companies like Yahoo recently. But actually, I think this revolution is here to stay. And once people have tasted moving into that freelance world, being somebody who has a bit more autonomy, they find it very difficult to move back, even though being freelance, working from home, being part-time, being a portfolio worker, can have a lot of insecurities, financial insecurities. Once you've tasted freedom, you almost never want to give it up again.
Roman Kaczmarek, author and founding member of the School of Life, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
If you've ever felt like customer support from a call center is hopeless, there are some statistics to back that up. Forbes recently reported that 50% of calls that go through call centers go unresolved. And IBM hopes to change that by putting their new star employee on the job, a supercomputer named Watson. Yes, that Watson.
Now we come to Watson. We're looking for Bram Stoker. And we find, who is Bram Stoker and the wager? Hello, 17,973, 41,413, and a two-day total of 77.
After outsmarting humans to win a Jeopardy championship, Watson was put to work in the medical field, helping doctors determine courses of treatment. Now IBM is shifting Watson's focus to customer service, where it thinks his unique skill set will be put to great use. And here to fill us in on Watson's post-Jeopardy career, Steve Gold. He's IBM's Vice President of Watson Solutions. And Steve, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Now, I think a lot of us speak with customer service computers, you know, at a bank or a pharmacy. That's not exactly what Watson is doing. What will Watson be doing?
It is a little bit different. And in fact, if we look at what most of us have grown up with in terms of computing, it's largely a programmatic approach. And when we think about programmatic computing, it has certain limitations. It's governed by, you know, what the program itself is intended to do. It's governed by rules and decision trees. And as a consequence, many of us have experienced the limitations of the systems and not getting to the outcome we're seeking, or not able to get to the right information at a point in time where it's actually actionable. Watson is a whole new generation of computing, a generation of cognitive systems. You know, and these systems are marked by a number of notable differences. First, the ability to navigate natural language. Now, this is a little bit different than speech recognition. For example, you know, asking a computer to comprehend how a house can burn up as it burns down, or why is it that, you know, feet smell and noses run? You know, these are things that, you know, humans, you know, understand with ease, but computers have always been challenged. So Watson has this innate ability to understand the complexities of human speech. Second, Watson can take vast amounts of information. In the case of Jeopardy, it was looking at about 200 million pages of data and providing insights and confidence-weighted responses in a little under 3 seconds. Now, for Jeopardy, that was important because that's how long it took Alex Trebek to read the question, and you couldn't buzz in before that question had been read. You know, for the call center, the performance characteristics will be aligned to the particular use case. But the third thing that cognitive systems do very well is they can learn.
So, Steve Gold, where is Watson right now?
Physically, Watson resides in a variety of data centers accessible through the internet. The latest offering is a software as a service, so it provides ubiquitous access to organizations that are looking to incorporate and embrace this technology. You know, Watson today is a very different system in that what we saw at Jeopardy was 90 IBM P750 servers working in tandem, 2,880 cores to process information, 15 terabytes of memory. That system today, on an apples-to-apples comparison, has been reduced by 75%, and the system now is 240% faster. And in fact, we can actually run Watson on a single P750 IBM server, which opens up a number of new opportunities as to where we potentially can take this technology.
So if somebody makes a call to a call center where Watson is operating or, you know, can operate through various different computer servers, will they actually have a conversation with Watson, or is this an automated conversation, or Watson is helping to feed information to somebody who's taking calls?
It's available in both configurations as an agent-assisted offering as well as a self-service offering. In a self-service, you know, an individual would be interacting directly with Watson, presenting questions in natural language and having a dialogue. Watson, when it fields a question or an input, is looking at its evidence, it's looking at its knowledge source, what we would call the corpus of information, and it's bringing back not just an answer, but it's bringing back a set of possible responses, and those each response is weighted with confidence, because there may be more than one answer, you know, to a possible question, and so Watson does two things. One, it certainly shares, as a humble genius, all of the possible answers that would fit the requirement that were established by the user's question. And two, Watson's willing to share the evidence that would support that answer. So it's always completely transparent.
What about pushback? I mean, because this is part of the criticism, right? That computers are replacing people more and more. They can provide better service. They don't cost as much money. I mean, do you at IBM, even when you're designing a system like Watson for call centers, do you engage in that debate?
I think it's different than maybe it's certainly a discussion. And, you know, I would say Watson isn't going to replace the agent. Actually, what Watson is likely to do is take away the undesirable aspect of the agent's job. So very few of the agents relish spending time on the phone with a customer looking through records and looking through product manuals to try to find the response. It's equally as frustrating for them as it is for the consumer. Where they really are great is building that relationship with that consumer. You know, one of our clients pointed out this is actually a great way to retain talent, because a lot of time the reason the talent leaves is they don't have the proper tools to do their job.
Steve Gold, we did a story on the program about Watson when Watson was on Jeopardy in 2011. And it was kind of funny because I'm having the same experience now. It's hard not to call Watson a he or a him, you know, right? To sort of imagine Watson sitting there as a big machine with, you know, one of those headsets on at a call center. But of course, clearly, Watson was designed to be responsive in a way to human interactions. How do you think of Watson inside of IBM?
You know, we you know, Watson is still an it. It's neither a he or a she, but you're absolutely correct. I mean, it's so easy, you know, to get comfortable as you would with an individual interacting with a Watson.
Steve Gold, Vice President of IBM's Watson Solutions Unit. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Now, you can find much more about the supercomputer called Watson, including some of the jobs he's been put to work doing after winning on Jeopardy. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, a blogger's stern warning to aspiring backyard chicken keepers. Don't do it unless you're willing to kill your hens. We'll get her take on why that's ruffled so many feathers when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Backyard chicken raising is one of the fastest growing facets of the local food movement. Across America, cities and towns have been reforming land use and health policies to accommodate the raising of chickens, which many people picked up after the 2010 outbreak of salmonella that led to the recall of 500 million eggs. Erica Strauss recently stirred things up when she urged readers of her blog to consider what keeping chicken means down the road. Killing them. Erica is a former professional chef turned gardening fanatic who blogs at Northwest Edible Life. Her writing has also been featured in Life Hacker, CNN's Eatocracy, and Reader's Digest Online. Erica, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much, Virginia.
So I've read a number of your pretty inoffensive posts on making DIY whole wheat waffle mix and exfoliant with baking soda and coconut oil, but you really stirred it up with this post on chickens. Did you know that when you wrote it?
I didn't know that this was going to be such a big post. I didn't know it was going to go quite as viral as it did. But I think it's an important topic, which is when you have this sort of urban homesteader, backyard chicken keeping popularity boom, making sure that people think about end-of-life planning for their chickens, which is something you should do whenever you take responsibility for an animal.
Okay, do the math for us, which is what you do in the article. Why should people not get backyard chickens unless prepared for their, as you say, end-of-life issues?
You have to understand that I'm coming from, and most of my readers are coming from, a situation where they're not rural. So they have a limited amount of space, and they have a limited amount of legal number of hens they can usually keep. So that's kind of what my readership tends to have as their limitation.
Mm-hmm.
A rural chicken keeper probably has room and pasture where they can let their chickens free range and really reduce their feed bill. And they probably have natural predation from coyotes or whatnot that's going to sort of tend to keep their chicken flock small. When you're an urban chicken keeper or suburban chicken keeper, you're probably importing a lot more feed. You're probably buying a lot more feed, which means the cost to keep your hens is going to be a little bit greater. And you probably don't have the same space to free range your chickens to the same degree, right?
Right.
So if you're having to pay for all of your food, I estimated based on the price I pay at my local feed store, which is definitely targeted towards urban chicken keepers, which is like code for expensive feed, right? I estimated that it would cost about $250 to keep one hen after they had stopped giving you eggs.
After what you call henopause.
Henopause, exactly. Because a lot of times, you know, people think you get a chicken and they just give you eggs. But it's a pretty intense experience for a chicken to make an egg almost daily, which is what many chicken breeds will do. And they just can't keep that up forever. So you kind of have this situation where if you want to have that continuing fresh backyard egg situation, you need to keep supplementing with younger hens who are able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that a lot of people maybe aren't thinking about going into backyard chicken keeping.
A number of people have commented on this. What about those who do keep chickens purely as pets? I mean, look at the pet care industry. It's in the billions of dollars for animals, caring for animals that don't produce anything except affection.
Chickens are wonderful pets. They're entertaining. They make great compost. They'll help aerate your garden. If you, you know, have a bug problem, they'll help you take care of your bugs. Kids love them. I think if people opt to keep their sort of post-laying or low-laying hens as pets, I think it's a wonderful decision. Great choice.
Well, your post got, as you said, it went viral. We saw it on several different websites. But it really, if I can say this, got people clucking about thinking of chickens as egg and meat machines alone, about veganism, about keeping pets and the nature of farming. What have you exposed here?
I think what I've exposed is that backyard chicken keeping trend that we've seen is young. And a lot of urban chicken keepers, I don't know what it's like out there for you guys, but here on the West Coast, sort of the corridor between Vancouver, BC, and Los Angeles, is just thick with urban homesteading movements all up and down the coast.
Same here.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful thing. I'm knee deep in it, and I love it. But it's immature, and sometimes people jump into these things without necessarily thinking through what it really means. It's sort of like that joke about, like, a puppy's not just for Christmas.
Right.
Well, an egg-laying hen isn't just for Easter or the time that it lays eggs. You really need to think about what your own philosophy is in regards to that hen after she stops laying so many eggs for you.
With all of this reaction, anything change your mind? Are you sorry that you posted this?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. I've actually been very pleased. It's been a remarkably civil discussion. I've been very happy with how the discussion and talking points in the comments have gone down. I've had posts that have gotten far more nasty than this one.
Well, Erica Strauss, I want to thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, Virginia. It was fun.
Erica Strauss blogs about urban homesteading herself at Northwest Edible Life. Her writing has also been featured in Life Hacker, CNN's Eatocracy, and Reader's Digest Online. And we'd love to know what you think. Do you have chickens in the backyard? And what are you planning to do with them when they stop laying eggs? Are your chickens more family pets than food source? Are you on the fence about whether to build that coop? And do you think it's time for a hard dose of realism for a somewhat romantic local food trend? You can post your poultry concerns on our Facebook page at Word of Mouth Radio. Lance Rice is a beer historian who for 40 years has been working to become an expert on all things beerish. He plans to write a book about North American breweries and their history, based partially on a trip planned with his nephew, Aaron. Aaron Rice is producer, director, and president of Rare Brain Studios, and he plans to chronicle their cross-country trip in a documentary film. The kicker here is that Lance has autism. The two are raising funds through a multi-platform Kickstarter project called Lance's Brewery Tour, a beer genius with autism and his dream. Since launching the campaign on May 13th, they've received a load of national attention for the project and join me now with more. Lance, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you.
Aaron, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Thank you for having both of us on.
Now, Aaron, you explained on the Kickstarter website that writing a book about North American breweries has been one of Lance's lifelong dreams. So how did Lance's dream jump through the hoops and become your project together?
You know, it goes back to New Year's Eve. I spent a lot of holidays with Lance, and every year I'd ask him what his resolutions were. And he mentioned for a long while that he wanted to write a book about the history of American brewing and American breweries. So that's where the idea started. And as my career progressed and I got further into film and TV production and writing, I saw that his story was beautiful and inspiring, and that a brewery tour was something I could take him on just as his nephew and his friend. But if I could capture that in a way that could help other people and show Lance's brilliance and his gift, we had something unlike anything that's out there.
Well, Lance, I'm curious about your inspiration. When did you first become interested in beer and breweries?
Well, it started when I was 16 years old. This was back in 1974, before my sophomore year in high school. And my younger brother, who was 14 at that time, he was away at basketball camp, and he had this box of beer stuff in his closet. And every day I would get down and I would look at it, and it was kind of interesting to me. I had seen this beer label, old one, called Sweet Life Premium Beer. It was brewed by the defunct Queen City Brewing Company of Baltimore, Maryland, which closed down 39 years ago in late October of 1974. So I guess the label, you know, just kind of struck me.
Lance, we're getting a little glimpse, I think, of your very acute photographic memory, but I must ask.
Yes, yeah.
Was 16 legal drinking age?
No. Well, at that time, this was
The 70s.
Well, this was, in fact, 1974, but 3 years earlier, the government had passed the Adults at 18 law, which meant that kids at 18 could legally buy alcohol, cigarettes, and they could vote. But I really didn't buy. Actually, my first six-pack till Labor Day weekend of 1978 when I was 20, 3-2 six-pack of Pabst Extra Light.
Well, Aaron, you know, I was reading about this project. Maxim magazine called it the world's most worthwhile Kickstarter. That is quite a thing. Have your plans for the project changed because of the flood of public support and press that you've received?
Our plans have changed. Originally, that 1,500-mile brewery tour was slated for mostly the Midwest and then some of the East Coast. Right now, the tour is frantically moving towards a nationwide brewery tour, going from the Eastern Seaboard through the Midwest, as far south as Louisiana and Texas, through California and up to Portland. So we are hitting every major beer city in America.
You're putting Lance's autism very much out front here. You know, you have posters, you have this Kickstarter campaign. It's all based on his autism. Lance, how do you feel about that? Is there a sense?
Oh, this is great. Very great. Very great. In fact, last month, my mom said she didn't realize this would be this really big. She thought it was just going to be a little trip, and she never realized it would be this really big. I never did either. You know, my nephew, Aaron, you know, he believed in my cause, and he believed in my dream, and he believed in hope, in my hope.
Well, Aaron, I'm wondering, what are some of the challenges you might anticipate while filming a documentary for both you and for Lance?
Some of the challenges for Lance, I'm interested to see, just because of the schedule and all of the work that goes into filming and writing a book, we're going to have a really busy schedule. I know Uncle Lance likes to go to the pool and go for bike rides, so I'm really going to mess up his routine. So I'm curious to see how that impacts him, and that will be part of the documentary. A good two-thirds, 80% of this is an amazing underdog story, a dream-come-true story. But there will be some very natural things that happen throughout filming that just highlight some of the challenges that Lance lives with. I think one of the things that's different about this is that we're capturing autism in a way that brings beauty to it. Lance didn't mention this before, but this period, the past month, month and a half, is the first time in his entire life that he referred to himself as living with autism. Mm. And that recognition has been incredible. And he speaks about it with pride, and he wants to inspire other people with autism. So we're excited to do that, but the challenges will be maybe dealing with some social phobia, dealing with routines and schedules, some of the very common difficulties that happen when you're living and working with autism.
I'm curious, Lance, the history of brewing in America is such an interesting story. Obviously,
yeah.
There are
yeah.
some pictures on the website here from Rare Brain Studios and at the Kickstarter site. These, you know, old, beautiful, majestic buildings that are just crumbling now. What are you hoping to get out of this tour? What are you hoping to teach us about the history of beer in the United States?
Well, that beer has been around for a long, long, long time. In fact, even before America even became a country, in 1587, Virginia colonists brewed the first ale using corn, but there were no commercial breweries yet at that time. In fact, before the Revolutionary War and during the Revolutionary War, all the beer and ale was shipped from Great Britain. George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were home brewers. And it was Thomas Jefferson, after the Revolutionary War, who was our second president of the United States, he said, I would like to see this beverage become more common.
I have to ask, what's your favorite beer, Lance?
I like them all. I'm not biased, but, well, light beer, I don't drink very, very much. But I like pretty much, I like India Pale Ale, lager beer. I like Bock beer and cream ale. I like ale, and I like Guinness Stout.
I would love to hear more from you guys on the road. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Sure. Glad to talk to you.
Lance Rice, beer historian who's planning on taking a cross-country tour of North American breweries beginning in June, depending on how their Kickstarter campaign goes, which looks pretty good. His nephew, Aaron Rice, is president of Rare Brain Studios. He's going to be joining Lance on the trip and shooting a documentary film while he's at it. You can find much more about Lance's brewery tour. A Beer Genius with Autism and His Dream is the name of the Kickstarter campaign. You'll find a link at wordofmouthradio.org. thanks so much for spending some time with us today. We do invite you to join in Word of Mouth's mission to spread new ideas. You can post links to segments on your Facebook page, you can retweet things you heard to your followers, or email segments to your friends. All it takes is a swift click on the Facebook, Twitter, or email icons at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again to hear more of what's bubbling up on Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
and Bill Barry.
And senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with plenty of help from our interns,
Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program
are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast
and listen to past shows, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr.
Follow us on Twitter.
And check out a playlist of music from the program
on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public
Radio.